Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At the time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Danielle, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Multiple Myeloma, and today's program is focusing really on an update on the treatment of multiple myeloma. This is part one, and we're very excited to have so many of you on the call today, and the call is on progress in the treatment of multiple myeloma. And this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and including the International Myeloma Foundation. And we're delighted with our collaborations with many organizations, and because of that, we've been able to reach about 667 people on the call today. So there's a lot of you on the call today. You come from all of the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, Ireland, the Netherlands, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. Today's program was made possible by Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company, Celgene, and an educational donation provided by Amgen. I really want to thank them for their support of the program and for their collaboration and partnership in making this program possible, not only this program, but the two-part series that we have that we're offering you. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about all of our collaborating organizations as a resource to you, and there's information about our speakers and the topics that they'll be addressing. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you all to take a moment at the end of the program today and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs and topics that we should be offering? Indeed, this particular series is one that many of you have asked us to offer, and indeed we take your recommendations very seriously and try very hard to implement your suggestions. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. William Bensinger. And Dr. Bensinger is Professor of Medicine and Oncology, University of Washington School of Medicine, Director, Autologous Bone Marrow Transplant Program, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, Member, Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. Dr. Bensinger is going to address an overview of multiple myeloma, current standard of care, new treatment approaches, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Bensinger.
Well, thank you very much, Carolyn. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be here and be able to speak on this topic. I'd like to start by telling you a little bit about the disease multiple myeloma. This is a cancer that involves the bone marrow, specifically involving plasma cells. And plasma cells are normal cells in our body that produce antibodies and reside in the bone marrow and also play an important role in bone metabolism. But when these abnormal plasma cells or myeloma cells develop, they fill up the bone marrow in an uncontrolled fashion and typically produce large amounts of proteins that we call monoclonal proteins that appear in the blood or urine and can be a marker of disease activity. In addition, by filling up the bone marrow, this often leads to lower normal blood counts, most commonly anemia or low red blood cells. It can also involve kidneys, and patients can develop kidney problems, bone disease with bone destruction, abnormally high calcium levels in the blood, and frequent infections. Now, the exact cause of myeloma is not known, but we know that genetic alterations occur in the DNA of the plasma cells and that eventually one of these cells accumulates enough genetic changes and damage that it leads to the development of myeloma. There's approximately 23 to 24,000 new cases of this in the U.S. every year, and at any one time, there's about 75,000 people living with this disease. The median age is about 69 years, and this is important because certain treatments, such as stem cell transplant, are limited to older patients and less commonly offered. Now, the disease is treatable with several types of chemotherapy, but is generally not thought to be curable for most patients. However, due to the use of transplant and the development of new drugs, the survival has more than doubled in the last 10 years. Patients who develop myeloma may experience bone pain or fatigue or weight loss, or they may have frequent infections. About 20% of patients have no symptoms or only very mild symptoms. The treatment is generally directed to patients with symptoms, reducing anemia, preventing or treating bone damage, lowering calcium levels in the blood, dealing with frequent infections, or reducing kidney damage. Now, sometimes patients with mild anemia or just perhaps some calcium loss without any actual direct bone damage may not be treated initially and may simply be observed. The treatment usually involves two or more drugs given in combinations, and responses to these drugs now are very high, approaching 100%. Only about 20% of patients to as high as 40% will achieve what we call a complete response, and I'll tell you what I mean by that in a minute. Stem cell transplant is an important component of therapy, and while the disease is becoming easier to treat with time, complete disease eradication still remains an elusive goal. Now, when we measure treatment response, we talk about achieving a remission or a complete response. And this means that all signs of the disease have disappeared from the blood. So there's no detectable abnormal monoclonal protein in the blood or in the urine. And when we look in the bone marrow, we can no longer find the abnormal plasma cells in the bone marrow. We don't generally define the bone lesions as having to disappear to call a remission, because typically these bone lesions take a long, long time to heal. Now, patients can achieve a complete response or remission or only a partial remission, but a response to therapy we think is important for the well-being of the patient. The treatments involve several classes of drugs. Corticosteroids, either prednisone or dexamethasone, are long-standing drugs that have been used in this disease. Alkylators, drugs such as cyclophosphamide, melphalan, or bendamustine are useful drugs. Anthracyclines, a somewhat less important class of drug, but these are occasionally used. Doxil or pegylated doxorubicin is one of these drugs. And two new classes of drugs that have really, I think, revolutionized the treatment of this disease: immunomodulatory drugs that include thalidomide, lenalidomide, and pomalidomide, and the proteasome inhibitors, bortezomib or carfilzomib, that have really change the way we do treatment. Now, patients generally receive initial therapy to get control of any of their symptoms, and in many cases it's useful to try to achieve a complete response, because we've been able to show that if you get a complete response, the disease stays under control longer and the survival is better for patients who get a complete response. But there has also evolved the concept of maintenance therapy, or what I will refer to as continuous therapy, that seems to become increasingly important. Since it's so hard to cure this disease, there is evidence that by continuous low-dose treatment or continuous therapy, we can improve the well-being and reduce symptoms of the disease. Now, when the disease does come back or relapse, transplant can also be used, but fortunately there are many new drugs that are becoming available, and I will mention that briefly, as well as Dr. Roget will mention that. The combinations that involve initial treatment can be two or three drug regimens, lenalidomide dexamethasone, or a combination of bortezomib, lenalidomide dexamethasone, or lenalidomide, dexamethasone, and Cytoxan. These drugs are commonly used in transplant patients. Older patients that are not transplant candidates may only be treated more commonly with lenalidomide dexamethasone or perhaps bortezomib, cyclophosphamide dexamethasone. And these choices really depend a lot on the presentation, how quickly it's important to get disease control, whether the patient has kidney abnormalities at diagnosis, and whether the patient may have certain high-risk genetic features in which certain drugs may work better than others. If a patient is relatively young and fit, we can use high-dose therapy, usually with melphalan, an autologous stem cell transplant, as a form of consolidation after initial therapy. And this generally results in higher response rates than conventional therapy and prolongs the disease-free interval and survival. It's a standard of care for most patients between up to the age of 65 to 70. Sometimes tandem transplants may be utilized to get better control of the disease. Occasionally, if a patient has very high-risk aggressive disease, donor transplants or allogeneic transplants may be used. But these are riskier procedures. Although they do have a better chance of working, they do expose the patient to a higher risk of complications, and as such are usually done within the context of clinical trials. Now, as I said, most patients up to age 70 can do this if they have a good performance status and adequate lung, liver, kidney, and heart function. The treatment can be used also in a relapse setting as well. We generally try to avoid certain types of drugs such as BCNU, bendamustine, or melphalan early on in the treatment because sometimes they can damage the marrow and they can affect the ability to collect stem cells. Now, due to several important trials, we do know that certain combinations may be better than others. For example, we have trials that have shown that a combination of bortezomib thalidomide index is better than a doublet of thalidomide and dex alone. Another trial showed, in fact, two trials showed that the regimen that we used to use, VAD, is no longer useful. That's a combination of vincristine, adriamycin, and dex, and bortezomib combinations have become preferred over that. There's also a trial that used lenalidomide dexamethasone induction, and then patients received either high-dose melphalan and transplant for two transplants, or they got a combination of melphalan, prednisone, and lenalidomide. And that trial showed that the high-dose melphalan treatments produced better progression-free survival. Now, for transplant-ineligible patients, one of the more important trials that was recently reported, called the FIRST trial, took patients and gave them lenalidomide and weekly dexamethasone for 18 months, or they got a combination of melphalan, prednisone, and thalidomide for 18 months, or the third group got lenalidomide and dexamethasone continuously beyond 18 months until disease progression. And that showed that the continuous treatment with lenalidomide dexamethasone produced much better progression-free survival compared to the year and a half of therapy and the other two treatment groups. And this is what I mean when I said that the concept of continuous therapy seems to be evolving. Now, at the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting that was held earlier this month, there were a couple of important trials showing the promise of several new classes of drugs. One is a group of drugs called histone deacetylase inhibitors. There was a large trial called the Panorama study, which added a histone deacetylase inhibitor, panobinostat, to a combination of bortezomib and dexamethasone and showed about a four-month improvement in progression-free survival. Another useful class of drugs that is really looking very exciting are monoclonal antibodies. These are antibodies with proteins specifically directed against proteins on the surface of plasma cells. And there are several new drugs that are directed against a target called CD38, which is a protein expressed heavily on plasma cells and myeloma cells. Two of these drugs, one is called daratumumab, and another one only has a name or a number assignment. It's called SAR650984. Showed that just the antibody alone could produce responses in between 25 and 40% of patients who had failed multiple other therapies. So these are exciting events, and I think there's going to be a lot more work done with these antibodies in the next few years. Now, the final topic I was asked to comment on was communicating with your healthcare team. So your healthcare team includes both your medical oncologist, but may include, depending on whether you need this treatment, a radiation therapist or a specialist in bone disease, an orthopedic surgeon. In addition, most teams use an advanced practice provider, either a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant. But the other important members of the team include the nurses, a pharmacist, dietitian, a physical therapist if you need one, and a social worker who can deal with some of the economic, social, or mental issues associated with your disease. It's really critical to engage and involve all of these people in your care, and you need to let them know as early as possible about changes in your symptoms or your work status or your mental well-being. That is really, that's the best way for them to be able to help you in terms of your care. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bensinger. That was really excellent and very comprehensive, and I really appreciate, and there'll be excellent questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Nupur Rajay. Dr. Rajay is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Director, Center for Multiple Myeloma, Division of Hematology and Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Rajay is going to address the role of clinical trials, how clinical trials contribute to treatment options, practical tips for side effect and pain management, including neuropathy, and bone health for people living with multiple myeloma. It's my pleasure now to introduce you and to bring on Dr. Rajay, who's been a frequent presenter, as has Dr. Bensinger, on many of our multiple myeloma teleconferences, our calls. Dr. Rajay?
Thank you, Carolyn. It is a real pleasure and an honor for me to be here and talking about the topics you've just outlined. And as you mentioned, Dr. Bensinger has given us a really comprehensive, excellent overview of myeloma. He's certainly highlighted some of the exciting things which were presented very recently at the American Society of Clinical Oncology. This is an annual meeting which we have once a year where the most exciting pieces in our fields are presented. So Dr. Bensinger has already mentioned some of those. What I will do now is give you an overview on clinical trials, talk to you about the importance of this, and walk you through some of those recent exciting advances which we had both at ASH, which was our American Society of Hematology meeting late last year, as well as this most recent ASCO meeting. I will also, as you just pointed out, Carolyn, touch on some of the toxicities associated with myeloma therapy and then try and discuss some aspects of bone disease. Now, because of this rapid evolution in all of the available therapies that you have for myeloma, I would strongly urge all of you to seek out clinical trials, communicate with your healthcare providers, and see what is available at your center and try and figure out if that particular trial would be appropriate for you. Talking about clinical trials, I will give you a little bit of a background on how we address these clinical trials. We do refer to these in different phases. We have what is known as a phase one trial. This is generally an early trial where we are trying to test a drug for myeloma generally for the first time. And the main goal of this kind of a trial is to see if you're able to tolerate this new drug. Then we have what we refer to as phase two trials, where we're looking to see how well these drugs work in multiple myeloma. And finally, we do have phase three trials, which compare the new drug which we are testing to the standard of care in myeloma. And this generally allows us to get drug approvals for this new drug. Excitingly, in myeloma, we've had at least 8 new drugs approved in the last 10 years, telling you how robust our pipeline is. And I would strongly, strongly urge all of you to seek out these trials. Additionally, in myeloma, a lot of times before we even get to even the early phase one trials, we've done a lot of preclinical work. When I talk about preclinical work, it's laboratory work where we've looked at these novel drugs in the setting of myeloma cell lines as well as patient-derived cells, and we already almost always have a very strong rationale for pursuing the clinical trial. So even if this is a phase one or an early clinical trial, again, I would urge everybody, because it's worth your time, to try and figure out if this would be appropriate for you in the right setting. Talking about the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting, Dr. Benzinger has highlighted a couple of things. I would reiterate one of the trials which he's mentioned, which is the Panorama trial. This was a trial testing a brand new concept. It was using a new kind of drug, also called HDAC inhibitors. And in this case, what the Panorama trial did was use a drug called panobinostat. Now, when you use panobinostat by itself, it does not work very much. But when you combine it with the bortezomib and dexamethasone, which a lot of you are familiar with using, what we found in this large randomized trial, and this would be referred to as the phase 3 trial, we found that patients who got panobinostat in addition to bortezomib and dexamethasone actually had improvements in their response rates and also had a good control of the disease for a prolonged period of time. And this was also seen in patients who were otherwise receiving bortezomib alone, and that bortezomib had stopped working, but adding on a drug such as panobinostat actually got the disease under control. Now, this would be, I hope, a trial which is going to get this new class of drugs approved for myeloma, so that we have the 9th drug combination approved for the treatment of myeloma. Again, Dr. Benzinger has mentioned another very interesting class of drugs, which is the monoclonal antibodies. We are all very excited about this, and he's mentioned two, one being daratumumab and the other being the SAR compound. Both of these are antibodies directed against a protein on all of your myeloma cells, and this protein is CD38. What is very interesting about these monoclonal antibodies is, as single agents, we are seeing responses in anywhere between 25 and 40% of patients. And now what we are going ahead and doing is combining these monoclonal antibodies with drugs like lenalidomide and dexamethasone. And with the addition of lenalidomide and dexamethasone, this response rate has gone up to 60, 70, and 80%. The other important thing to note about these monoclonal antibodies is they are extremely well tolerated. Talking about monoclonal antibodies, there were a few others which are quite exciting. One of them, which is most advanced in its development, is an antibody known as elotuzumab. It is directed against a protein called CS1. This protein is pretty much present on all of your myeloma cells, and we have a phase 3 trial which is completed, and our hope is that this trial is going to be presented later on this year. And again, our hope is that we'd have a monoclonal antibody approved for the treatment of multiple myeloma. In addition to all of this, we have a whole bunch of other newer classes of drugs. Some of these are called KSP inhibitors. There's a drug called ARY-560. It's the array compound. This is being used in combination both with bortezomib and the other proteasome inhibitor called carfilzomib. There are other interesting novel drugs called, and these work through hypoxia. Hypoxia is a situation where you have less oxygenation to your bone marrows, a very interesting drug which was presented at this most recent ASCO meeting was a drug called TH302. As you will notice, the drugs which are in very early development, which Dr. Benzinger has also mentioned, these generally don't have names as yet. These have letters and numbers, and once these are successful, they will eventually get a name. TH302 has been used in myeloma, and it's generally well tolerated, and again, as a single agent, we are seeing responses in about 30 to 40% of patients. Again, the overarching theme in the last year or last couple of years, which was again reiterated at our annual meeting, the annual oncology meeting, was the fact that it is important for myeloma patients to stay on drug for as long as possible. So continuous treatment seems to get your disease under better control. And if your disease is under better control and you do not have a progression of your disease, you are going to be feeling well. Your quality of life is going to be very important. And therefore, I think the next piece, which I'm going to focus on now, is toxicities, because if you stay on drugs long enough, one needs to be kind of aware of some of the toxicities of all of these compounds, and symptom control and your quality of life becomes extremely important. Now, when thinking about symptoms and symptom control in myeloma, I will try and discuss this in the context of both disease as well as the therapy that you're getting for this. One of the symptoms, which Dr. Benzinger has already mentioned, is bone disease. And bone disease can cause devastating symptoms in the way of bone pain. It can also result in problems such as bone fractures. It can cause kidney damage because of increased calcium, which is leached out of your bones. Now, there's a lot of different strategies we've used for bone disease, but the one most important strategy is the use of bone-strengthening agents, which are known as bisphosphonates. The two drugs which are commonly used in the treatment of multiple myeloma are drugs called pomiginate, also known as Iridia, which you may be familiar with, or a drug called zoledronic acid, or Zometa, which is recommended for the treatment of myeloma bone disease. There's another new novel drug which we are testing in the context of bone disease, and this novel drug is a monoclonal antibody. This is called denosumab. It is a monoclonal antibody directed against a protein called RANK ligand, and we presented this data at this ASCO meeting. What we are doing here is comparing the use of this monoclonal antibody called denosumab with zoledronic acid or Zometa, which all of you are probably familiar with the hope that denosumab is going to do just as well as zoledronic acid and potentially may even do better than zoledronic acid when it comes to controlling bone-related issues, which are quite central to multiple myeloma. Again, there are a few other issues which come up with bone disease, and as Dr. Benzinger has mentioned already, you might sometimes need the assistance of an orthopedic surgeon or a radiation oncologist. I will stress, however, that we like to minimize radiation for the treatment of bone disease, but occasionally one needs things like a surgical procedure for fixing bones which are weak and are potentially likely to fracture. There are certain situations, specifically in the spine bones, and myeloma patients during the course of their disease can end up with fractures in the spine. There are certain non-invasive or minimally invasive procedures, such as vertebroplasties or kyphoplasties, which are very easy and can help relieve some of those compression fractures which you have related to bone disease. Other common symptoms from myeloma are fatigue, and fatigue is commonly associated with because of the anemia associated with multiple myeloma. We have used drugs like erythropoietin, which is a growth factor which helps your red blood cell count to come up. We generally are careful about using drugs like erythropoietin in the early stages when you're just recently diagnosed with myeloma because it can cause problems of thrombosis. But later on, during the course of your disease, some of these drugs are quite useful for the treatment of your anemia. The other problems one has with myeloma, kidney dysfunction, and patients with multiple myeloma should avoid drugs which can cause kidney problems such as ibuprofen, and should try and keep themselves well hydrated throughout. Again, risk of infections do exist with myeloma, and we do recommend that you get your flu shots, get your pneumonia shots on time, and if you end up having any kind of infection, make sure you communicate to your healthcare provider, because we generally have a low threshold to start you on an antibiotic. Now, again, as mentioned, all of these novel agents we've talked about are very, very effective and are generally well tolerated. But given that we are now postulating that you use them for continued periods of time, they do come with some of the toxicities, and it is very important that you understand some of these toxicities. And again, you being the captain of your body, you will be alerting your healthcare provider to some of these symptoms. So knowing the toxicities from these is going to be helpful for you. For example, if you are using drugs like lenalidomide or thalidomide, these drugs tend to predispose you to toxicities such as thrombosis or blood clots. Depending on what drugs you're on with these agents, or depending on certain risk factors such as cardiac risk factors you might have, we sometimes will recommend the use of blood thinners such as low molecular weight heparin or Coumadin. These drugs can also cause a decrease in your blood counts, can also cause anemia, which can result in fatigue, and therefore adjusting some of these medications, adjusting their doses, tends to be helpful while you're on medications such as lenalidomide. The other drug which we commonly use in the treatment of multiple myeloma is bortezomib. All of you are familiar with the use of bortezomib, and in the old days, we certainly used it intravenously. We used it twice a week, and with that, we did see a significant impact with neuropathy associated with the bortezomib. I will tell you that this neuropathy has decreased considerably. This is in part because we're using it more weekly. We are also using bortezomib under the skin or subcutaneously, and by doing so, we've been able to decrease the frequency of neuropathy by at least twofold. But if you do end up with neuropathy, the big things to do is dose adjust the drugs like bortezomib and also use adjunctive treatments. We tend to supplement you with B vitamins, so B6 vitamins, B12 vitamins, very important. Supplement with folic acid is important as well. And the biggest thing you can do for neuropathy is try and prevent it. Once it sets in, though, then the treatment is mainly symptomatic. We do use drugs like gabapentin or Neurontin for the treatment of bortezomib-related neuropathy. You can use drugs such as Cymbalta as well, and all of these would help with the symptoms associated with neuropathy. Again, it's excitingly, we have new proteasome inhibitors, and these are oral proteasome inhibitors such as MLN9708, also called ixazomib, and there's another new one called oprazomib. All of these are in the context of clinical trials as we speak, and all of these drugs have very little in terms of toxicities in the way of neuropathy. So the hope is that this is associated neuropathy that you had seen in the past with thalidomide and with the bortezomib, hopefully we're going to see less and less of this. Carfilzomib is generally well tolerated, sometimes can cause problems with fluid overload and cardiac-related issues, and I think having a discussion with your healthcare provider and making sure that you are on a reasonable diuretic or giving the carfilzomib over a longer infusion period of time helps minimize some of the side effects associated with carfilzomib. Now, given the complexity of all of these symptoms, both from the disease and from some of the drugs that we give you, I think it's extremely important for you to partner with your healthcare team, and communicating all of these symptoms and concerns will allow not only you, but also will allow your healthcare team to help manage your myeloma in the best possible way. And again, we are where we are in myeloma because of your ability and your willingness to participate in clinical trials, which is how we've gotten all of these 8 new drugs approved. with all of the excitement with the monoclonal antibodies, with some of the new drugs that I've talked about, I think if there is an available clinical trial, seeking that out and participating in that is going to be really helpful moving the field forward. With that, I'm going to end here, Carolyn, and address questions at the end of this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rajay. That was really an excellent, extraordinary presentation and really a wonderful focus on really the quality of life issues. Thank you so much. Excellent. And our next presenter is Ms. Sarah Kelly. Ms. Kelly is coordinator for our Older Adult Services Program at Cancer Care. She is an oncology social worker, and she's going to address really all of the free psychosocial support services that Cancer Care offers here, and as well as the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and I'd like to thank also Dr. Bensinger and Dr. Rajay. I think we've got so much good information today. So as Dr. Messner said, I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people coping with multiple myeloma and also their family members and friends. And we've been talking today just about treatments and managing your care, and I'd like to really talk about how the importance of creating a support network and building a support network can be a part of that care and how cancer care can be a part of that. So just a little bit about who Cancer Care is. We are a national nonprofit organization. We provide free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling. We provide that face-to-face in the New York area and over the telephone nationally. We have support groups, which we also provide face-to-face in New York, over the phone nationally and online nationally and internationally. We have education programs like the one that we're all on today. We provide practical help, how to navigate the healthcare system. We also have some limited financial assistance as well as chemotherapy copay assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers, and as Carolyn said a moment ago, they're completely free of charge. Oncology social workers really are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, really the support network. We're also trained to help cancer patients and their supports tackle the problems that accompany the disease. So financial demands, physical changes due to diagnosis and treatment, social adjustment, psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis is really an important part of the healing process. You know, it's for me, it's up there with treatment. It's such an important part of this. So as you know, cancer affects the whole person, right? It's not just physical. It also affects many other areas of your life. It affects your emotional health, and it also affects your support network, so your family, friends, the people that are there with you. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling, it's a sign of strength, and this is something I'd really like you to take home with you, that it really, you do not have to do this alone. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through something similar or have similar problems. You know, if you do individual counseling, it really is a space that's just yours to voice any concerns. And I feel these connections really help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. I think if you're feeling well emotionally, it can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what we have available now. At this time, Cancer Care is providing an online support group for people who were diagnosed with blood cancer. So that absolutely includes multiple myeloma. We also are providing two general patient support groups. One is a phone group and one is a face-to-face group. And then we have also a caregiver group that one is face-to-face, telephone, and also online. So just know that those services are there. If you're interested in any of our services, you can always call us on our HOPE line, and that's 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673. And you can also visit our website, which is www.cancercare.org. And you guys, you probably have this in the packets in front of you, but I just wanted to make sure that you have that information. And I definitely recommend visiting our website. We have a very comprehensive website. You can find a lot of information, you know, not only just on support, but also on all of our programs, as well as your diagnosis, treatment, and, you know, some coping also as you go through this. So there's just a lot on there. We've learned a lot from today's program, and there's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. Our social workers, really, we're here to help you understand what it means for you and your family. We can help you prioritize, and if you need to rehearse questions or talk with your medical team, I know both Dr. Bensinger and Dr. Rajay both brought this up. You know, we can help you with that, you know, in terms of questions you may want to be asking. And really, as I said earlier, I want you to take home that you're not alone. You know, we are here to help you. Thanks so much for your attention and the opportunity to talk today.
Oh, thank you so much, Sarah. That was really excellent. And now we have time for questions, and a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Danielle to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we'll have all of our speakers on board to address your questions. Danielle?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Susan M. Susan, can you please press star 1 again?
Oh, Susan,
and your line is now open.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi, Susan.
Hi. Yes, I have a question. My husband was taken off of Zomata a few years back because he developed a case of the necrosis in his jaw.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible for him to go back on that?
Oh, that's an excellent question, Susan. Thank you, Dr. Rajay. Could you address that question?
Yeah, that's a great question, Susan, and I did not mention, but, you know, if you've been on drugs like zoledronic acid or pimodrinate, we certainly have seen a complication known as osteonecrosis of the jaw, and it really is an effect of long-term use of these drugs. And the few things for everybody to kind of focus in on is, make sure you have good dental hygiene, make sure cleanings all along, and avoid things like surgical procedures to the jaw or tooth extraction. Once you have developed ONJ, most of us generally will take a patient off zoledronic acid. Having said that, if the ONJ is a grade 1 ONJ and it's healed up nicely now, Susan, and the risk of bone disease is greater than that small ONJ issue in the mouth, then, after discussing this with your oncologist, it would be perfectly fine to go back on to the zoledronic acid. It'll have to be a risk-benefit discussion between you and the oncologist, though, for you to go back on to the zoledronic acid.
Thank you. And our next question?
If you do have a question at this time, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
There is a question from one of our participants on the web. Can Velcade cause cardiac arrhythmias? Dr. Rajay, could you address that?
Sure. So, we've seen cardiac toxicity, but it's very, very rare with Velcade. It's more a little bit of a fluid overload. Arrhythmias in the setting of new myeloma sometimes has happened. I'm not sure one can completely relate it to bortezomib, though. You do have electrolyte abnormalities. You have seen occasional arrhythmic events, so it can happen. Whether it's definitively due to drug is not absolutely certain. But I think it's important to recognize that, when you're first getting treated, either in the upfront setting or even if the disease has come back, there's all kinds of other things going on as well. And with myeloma, your heart is a little bit in a stress situation because you can get high output failure with the myeloma itself. So because there's so many competing things going on, it's not definitive that it's because of Velcade, but one would have to take it on a case-by-case basis and address it that way.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And thanks so much, Dr. Ajay. And we have another question from one of our participants. How long does it take before you feel side effects from Revlimid with dexamethasone once a week? Dr. Bensinger, could you address that question?
Well, the side effects from Revlimid or the side effects from dexamethasone, either alone or in combination, vary greatly from patient to patient, but can be felt sometimes immediately. So with lenalidomid or Revlimid, patients may feel some fatigue. They might feel a little bit cloudy in terms of their thinking. Patients describe it as a fog that they may feel. Those can occur with immediate treatment. Some of the other side effects may take a little longer. For example, patients who are on lenalidomid maintenance may develop some diarrhea symptoms that can occur with long-term use. Dexamethasone, usually if it occurs, it's going to be a fairly quickly an immediate effect. Patients may have trouble sleeping or may feel energized, almost a manic type state when you're taking the drug. And then what happens is, as the effect of the drug wears off, patients can actually, to some degree, go into a depression. Now, fortunately, that doesn't happen to every patient who takes the drug. It only happens to a small percentage of patients. But these effects can occur right away.
Excellent. So we have another question from one of our online participants. I'm going to actually summarize it a bit. A person who had participated in a clinical trial, and then treatment was stopped. They were doing well. They had a very rapid and early response to the treatment and achieved a full remission, confirmed by bone marrow biopsy last month. However, the comment is, after listening to today's webcast, however, I'm feeling worried about not being on maintenance therapy. What are your thoughts? And so the treatment started in April of 2013, ended in March 2014, and the person's tested every second month, blood and urine, with biopsy annually. Now, I realize this is a very unique question to the individual, but I wonder, Dr. Bensinger, if you can address it perhaps in a more general way, if this is a question that people do have about being on maintenance therapy at some point or going off treatment.
Well, the data that's available suggests that patients who stay on their treatment, if it's working well, tend to have fewer complications and have a better quality of life. This is because of good disease control and the lack of symptoms from the progression of the disease. It's impossible to answer specifically for this individual patient, but if they got a complete remission, and I don't know exactly why they might have gone off the drug, perhaps it was a fixed duration of treatment, or perhaps this was their decision to go off the drug, I generally recommend in patients who are on a trial of a new drug, if it's working well and they're tolerating it well and not having side effects, I tend to keep patients on these drugs more or less continuously.
Excellent. Thank you. And another question from someone who online participant. I'm scheduled to have a stem cell transplant in a few months. How should I prepare and what should I expect? Dr. Bensinger? It's a general question.
Well, you want to make sure that you're eating well and maintaining good nutrition. You want to make sure that you're exercising so that you're fit. If you have medical conditions that might complicate your treatment, if you have any heart problems or lung problems, they should be addressed so that things are optimized. I think that if you are concerned about your dentition, you may want to see a dentist. You should probably have your teeth clean so that that issue doesn't come up during your pre-transplant evaluation. And then, of course, most important is you want to make sure that your myeloma is under good control going into the transplant, and that's going to mean perhaps more therapy.
And we also have another question, which was covered in part, but are there any long-term effects, negative effects of Zometa or Ridia? One of our online participants is asking that question, although it has been addressed in part by Dr. Rajay. But Dr. Bensinger, could you add anything to that?
Well, the Dr. Rajay talked about ONJ, which is certainly one of the complications. These drugs can affect kidney function long-term and can cause, for example, the leaking of proteins or what we refer to as proteinuria. The serum creatinine level can rise. And basically, you need to just monitor patients' kidney function while they're on these drugs and measure the creatinine and check the urine for protein excretion as a measure of picking up early any problems that might develop. If that starts to occur, it may be desirable to reduce the dose of the bisphosphonate or to increase the interval between treatments as a way to be proactive.
And another online question. If I want to exercise, but my energy levels are always low and I feel sluggish, what can I do to improve this? Again, it's a general question, but Dr. Benson, if you could give some tips to this person in terms of what they might.
Well, that's a tough one. I think you need to try to determine why you're feeling fatigued. For example, if the fatigue is due to a low blood count, if you're anemic, correcting that with transfusion support. If you boost your hemoglobin or hematocrit, you may find you have more energy. Commonly in patients who have myeloma, depression can occur due to the disease and its effects on your mental health. And so if you think you might be depressed as a cause of your fatigue, that should be something that could be addressed with perhaps an antidepressant therapy, but it's something you want to talk to your doctor about whether that might be appropriate.
Thank you. And there's a question actually for Ms. Kelly in terms of people wondering about in a group, do people share information with each other, kind of more questions about what exactly happens in a support group? I wonder if you could comment on that.
Absolutely. So, in the support group, absolutely, I think people do share information. You know, again, with these things, it's never one size fits all. I mean, we're all very unique. So, of course, treatment does vary in some cases, but information does get shared, and it's so that, we come together to talk about that, but also a lot of what we talk about is just the emotional impact, what it's like to go through the treatments, some ways of coping as you're going through the treatments, so, that's a big part of it, too.
Excellent. And another question actually for Dr. Bensinger from one of our online participants. Is it necessary to be revaccinated after stem cell transplant? If yes, how soon? And when traveling to third world countries, must I receive the recommended immunizations again when they've been given previously? Are antimalarials safe to take after transplant? So complex question, and of course,
sure.
Individuals,
but
if you have general guidelines.
Generally, within after 6 months from an autologous stem cell transplant, it's safe to be revaccinated. Now, certain things you can test for. You can test, for example, to see if patients have antibodies to certain pathogens that normally are vaccinated for. And if the patient has adequate levels in their blood, they don't need to be revaccinated. It is safe to take antimalarials, but we don't recommend travel before 6 months so that your immune system can more fully recover from this. There are certain vaccines that we recommend in patients who may not have ever had vaccination. For example, hepatitis. We strongly recommend that patients receive vaccines to the newly available hepatitis types that are available, for example, hepatitis C. And these can go a long way to protecting you in the future.
Excellent. Thank you. I have to say this has been an extraordinary call. I want to thank Dr. Rajay, Dr. Bensinger, and Ms. Kelly. So just this has been a really wonderful call, and they've been one wonderful team, and also all of you have asked such really great questions, both on telephone and online. and all of you who have been listening as well. I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour education program and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so therefore, as Ms. Kelly had said earlier, we have at Cancer Care a staff of many oncology social workers who are here to provide support and help to you in your coping with multiple myeloma or with cancer in general. We want you to know that you can contact us at any time. You have our 800 number, 1-800-813-HOPE. That number has been given out a lot to you. And our staff provide, again, both practical and financial assistance as well as counseling services. And that really is a word that means a chance to talk with our professionally trained oncology social work staff, to talk with someone about concerns you might have or to help you to problem solve, to figure something out. Also to answer some of your questions about your care. We often will talk with you and help you maybe to frame the questions to bring back to your healthcare team. Because ultimately it is your healthcare team who can answer some of your medical questions, but sometimes it's hard to frame those questions. And so actually having someone to kind of talk with, sometimes in a support group or with an oncology social worker, it can help you then to figure out what is that question you want to ask and making those lists of questions so that they're most helpful. Also, I want to remind all of you that this is part one of a two-part series, and so there is part two coming up, which is coping with the stresses of caregiving when your loved one has multiple myeloma. And I would say that the coping with the stresses applies to both the person with multiple myeloma as well as the family member and caregiver. So we do open that call up to anyone who wants to hear a bit about coping with stresses, because that often is an issue that many people confront in coping with cancer. And as we're about to conclude the program, most importantly, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with multiple myeloma or cancer. You are now part of the cancer care community, and we're here to help you. Please take advantage of calling us on the phone or visiting our website. We are here to help you. Thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.